So the children will be with us for a few minutes. It's Gisha likes to have the children do the mantras too, because they're young and sort of pure. They haven't been around long enough to have the baggage that most of us adults have. So they're saying the mantras really is very powerful. Has a real positive beneficial effect for all of us. So the Tayata, the first mantra, Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra, I was explaining it earlier today. It's kind of like if you're a cook and you've done a reduction, and then you do another reduction of the reduction and another reduction of that reduction, all the Buddha's teachings can be reduced into this line. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamuni Soha. So we're going to do that mantra, and it focuses the mind, and it has a vibration, and it has, these are sacred words and sounds. So just, you know, as much as you can, be open to that possibility. And we'll do that together. Then we'll do the four measurables in English. And then, Jill, if you could help us. Was that an insect? Oh, bless your heart. God, he's saving a life. Yata O Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soa Tayata O Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soa Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soa. Is that seven? Is that all we do is three? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Okay, we'll do four measurables. We know there are four of these. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And I definitely need help with this. And Jantan Che De Wea Dong De Wea Gyu Dong Dam Pa Gyu Chik Du Gnya Dong Du Gnya Gyi mantra seven times. Oh, eight times. Okay. Hang on a minute. I'm going to count these. Okay. You want to do this? Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 So that's the mantra of the Buddha of compassion. This is Green Tara, is the mantra of the Buddha. She represents compassion, but action, compassionate action. So as we do this mantra, think of that meaning, but focus on the sound and the words. Okay. Om Tari Du Tari Du Re So Ha. 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 Okay, so the children may leave now. Or, yeah. Yeah. Let's start out with meditation. Yeah, and we'll do. If you've not, has anybody here never meditated at all? Anybody like never done it? Well, it's real simple. What I'm going to teach is very simple. All you have to do is be able to count to 21. You'll be lucky. You probably won't have to count much past 5. But if you make it to 21, great. But we're going to focus on the breath. And you can focus on the entire experience of breathing, or just the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose, or the rising and falling of the abdomen. But it's going to be out. You know, you'll breathe out quietly, like that, but don't make noise like I did. Breathe out, just following the breath. We're not forcing it out, forcing it in, forcing it out, forcing it in. Just breathe out and in, and then like mentally note 1, out, in, mentally note 2, out, in. And if you get up to 21, fantastic, but most of us will get lost after 3 breaths and then have to go back to the beginning, which is fine. So we'll do that, out in 1, out in 2, and so forth. And again, here's the main instruction. I can't hear this enough personally, and I've been trying to do this for years, but if your mind gets distracted, and it will, by thoughts, because as we pointed out earlier, this is boring. Following your breath is not interesting. Unless you understand the benefits of it, it is boring. So your mind is going to go off after you. Your mind is going to chase something that's interesting, or that you're attached to, or you're blah blah blah. And so our job is to follow the breath, and then when the mind goes off, which it will, and it may take you may be gone for 5 minutes before you realize you're gone, you gently bring the mind back and place it on the breath again, and then you continue the process. Start back at 1, out in 1, out in 2, like that, and you bring it back, and you bring it back, and you bring it back as many times as you can. And that is the crucial. That is meditation. It's literally the bringing back of the mind. But you have to be alert, and you have to have mindfulness of the breath. So this is a good practice for us. And if your mind goes away, are you bad and wrong? No. We don't know how to do this. We haven't trained our minds. So don't judge yourself. Be very neutral about this and bring it back as many times as you need to. So we'll do this for about an hour. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. if you're walking along a path with a child and the child wanders off the path, you might gently but firmly bring the child, you know, take the child by the hand and lead it back onto the path. It's the same attitude that we need to have with our mind, gently but firmly bring the mind back and refocus it on the experience of breathing without any judgment. So the many motivations that you could have for practicing, for doing anything really, but particularly when you're doing spiritual practice, it could be you just want to, for most of us, it's pretty much limited to this life, you know, we just want to be able to cope and, you know, make it through the day and be a happier person and not be so angry and stressed out and depressed and whatever. Handle difficulties. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's a motivation that's like about a billion times more powerful than that one. And it's not natural to think this way, but it's the motivation that we aim to in Mahayana Buddhism. And that is that we want to set our goal, set our sights on developing all of our good qualities, compassion, wisdom, skillful means, like what to say and do in any situation to be helpful, and power. You know, these are the main qualities of an enlightened being. We want to develop those qualities as, you know, fully developed, and we want to eliminate every single mistake in the mind. Seems impossible, doesn't it? But that's the goal. It's like the tip of Mount Everest, right? So we want to get, that's the mountain we want to climb, and we want to do it for others. Which normally we think, I'm doing it for my own sake. But in Mahayana Buddhism, the goal is to is to achieve full enlightenment for others' sake, for the benefit of all beings. It's so antithetical to our normal, egocentric, self-centered way of thinking. That's why it's so powerful. As much as you can, set your mind with this kind of motivation that we're here today to listen and think about the teachings and analyze them and see what works for us and to sort of develop ourselves further along our own path in order to be able to more perfectly serve others. And if you want to distill it down to one sentence, Lama Yeshe used to say, as much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. As much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. That's the essence of it. I didn't introduce myself at the beginning. My name is Don Brown. I'm one of the people that teaches Discovering Buddhism, and I'm an old timer. That's a fair statement, isn't it? I've been around the Kadampa Center for many years, and I've been studying Buddhism for a long time, 30 some years. So not every day, and not. I'm not a great example. That's the bad news. Geshe-la's not here. He's like the living, example of the teaching. So you have these Westerners, like, I guess Robbie will be up here in a couple. He's much more enlightened than I am. But, having people who are like living examples of the teachings is so helpful. That's why we have to pray that Geshe-la will come back soon, healthy, and, but anyway, Lama Yeshe used to say that for beginners, he felt like that Westerners were good for other beginners. So I'm kind of an advanced beginner, but I can still consider myself a beginner. So we're going to talk today about some things that people, I think, are going to, I'd like to address things that people struggle with, basically, in Buddhism. There was Jill, I'm going to need you again. At the board. So, the Buddha taught that, it's said, because we don't know what the Buddha taught, do we? We have the books. So, but we're going to say the Buddha taught that he said, you should examine my teachings carefully, like somebody who's assaying gold would assay it. They chop it up in little pieces and put different acids. Is this really gold or is it fool's gold? Test it out. Test it. Make sure it is what it is. Make sure, from the perspective of the Dharma, make sure it makes sense to you. It's logical. It helps your mind. It doesn't harm you. It doesn't harm others. And if the teachings are like that for you, then you might want to work with it in your life and live your life as if this was maybe a new reality for you to think about. So with that being said, notice that we said things I don't like about Buddhism. We didn't put Kadampa Center in here. But it's not the time to, but this is more time to focus on, like, what are you struggling with? The word I don't like is not what I really wanted to say. So things that you're struggling with, and I'll start it off because the last session I said, you know, when I first got in, you know, walked into the, you know, to a Tibetan Gompa many years ago, it was so foreign, you know, it was like all this iconography and all the colors, and I even wore my Tibetan Buddhist shirt today, you know, all the colors and everything were kind of off-putting to me, and the monks too. It's a strangeness of everything, because I was raised Presbyterian. Anybody know what that means? Anyway, I was not a very good Presbyterian, but could we just write down the sort of, what's the right word, like foreignness of it? Don't write too big. We're gonna hopefully we'll come up with a list. Now, is there a microphone? Where's the mic? Because I want people to. I'm in a point. We'll have it. We're not gonna let this go on forever, but we'll probably, if we can come up with 10 good points. Okay. Well, I'll repeat it for the streamers at home. I guess it was streamed, didn't it? I don't know. All right, so foreignness. Okay, who over here in this first couple of rows? In the back, yes.
So I think one of the things that's always been very confusing for me is that there are five of this, eight of that, they're all these things.
List. Oh, I love it. Thank you for, we were talking about that, the lists. Countless lists. Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. And you're right. You will never be a good Buddhist if you can't remember those. There are lots of lists. Yes. All right. Come on over here. I need this side of the room to show up. All right. Well, let's see. We can say giving up. Let's just say it another way. Can't have fun. Buddhism seems to be saying, oh, we can't have fun. We have to give up our attachment. And attachment looks like our friend, doesn't it? It does. Attachment looks like a friend. Anger is easy to see as an enemy, but attachment is very difficult. Yeah. Joey? So daily practice and what the practice, okay? Yeah, it's a little confusing because you don't, nobody. Yeah. Okay. The back rows back here, we have to see some hands coming up. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, emptiness.
Confusing. Emptiness is confusing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. It is. Next row. Yes.
You have a mic now? Is it on? That I have to take personal responsibility for everything. Like I can't blame anyone anymore for why things aren't working.
Okay. That has to do with karma, doesn't it? Personal responsibility / karma. Yeah. Anybody? How about the next row? There's some people there that I'm sure. Wait a minute now. All right. Wait a minute. We're jumping around now. It's okay.
I think one thing that is confusing or is hard to deal with is self-forgiveness, because mm-hmm. when you fail to be kind or fail to be mm-hmm. to not attach yourself or with the resentment.
Self-forgiveness. Great, great question.
I'm very new to Buddhism, and I have a question about kindness, and when is it always, what, I guess in my personal life, sometimes I struggle with always being kind and then people taking advantage of me, and when to put your foot down and be kind but not let people step on you, and where that line is, because sometimes I tend to extremes where I'm very, very soft and kind and let people take and take and take. And then I'm like, no. And I get very firm and angry. And there's the middle ground that I'm trying to find.
Thank you. That's a great question. We probably won't get to that one. No, it's a great question. Yeah. These are great questions. Let's see. What's the hand, David?
So my question would be, I think overall the concepts of Buddhism are wonderful and they have helped me a great deal, but I really cannot understand daily practice, as in sitting on a cushion, meditating, or saying mantras. I have tried it some, and it just does not seem to do anything for me. My mind does not seem different. I don't seem to feel any better or worse. And I'm kind of mystified about what it does for other people. I assume it must do something for some of the people.
Daily practice is not yielding results.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
The daily practice actually comes in our daily walk, and every opportunity, every interaction with another human being, we have the opportunity to practice.
Yeah.
And I know for me, I struggle too with sitting on the cushion. And I think what I've tried to do more is in every single interaction, take the opportunity to practice.
Yeah. So daily, you know, trying to make daily practice work. And next, we got a few more. Let's get like maybe three or four more, and then we'll try to, you know, have some open discussion about this.
It's that Buddhism is like a million page book. It feels like there's books about books.
About books.
Yeah, there's like the distilled book is still a massive book. It just feels to me like if there was a way to kind of really boil it down to like the Cliff Notes, it would be a lot. Yeah. but still gets to the heart of the practice. Like mm-hmm. it just feels like there's just like, you know, the Discovering Buddhism class is like a 2-year class, and then there's like another class after that class, and then I think there's like another class after that class. Just a way to make it, maybe this is another derivation of the massive list, but just more. It seems like it's so spread everywhere.
It's vast.
Yeah.
Buddhism is vast. Where do we start? Okay.
It's not terribly off-putting, but the iconography is a little tough for me sometimes. All the statues and flags and...
And
lotus flowers.
The stupas and mm-hmm. like what is all that about? That goes back to my first thing, but similar, yeah, the iconography and stuff like that, yeah.
I think one of the hardest things to me coming to Buddhism is the lack of female lamas and tukus and leaders.
Mm-hmm. You haven't met Venerable Rabina yet, have you?
I know of her, but I haven't been lucky enough to.
Oh, you should be here.
I have had some very good female teachers. But starting out, I just noticed it was predominantly male-led, like the other religions I'd come from.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good one. Good point. Anybody else? Okay. Actually, I think it's good just to write them down, even if we don't, let people bring them up, even if we don't get to talk about everything. Go ahead.
This is not as deep as everything. You know, this is more superficial than the others, but I'm not physically able to sit cross-legged, and so I feel like I'm missing out on something.
Ah, okay, and you are. Sore knees.
Yeah, I second that. There's a lot of ritual sayings every time we meet, and I'd like to know more about the English version of that. You know, I've delved into Om Mani Padme Hum some, and it's changed when I'm doing a mala. It's changed my intention. It's changed my the spirit in which I do that. Even if I can't remember what each individual word means, having studied that some, it changes it. So just knowing what some of the typical things that we say in Tibetan language, what they mean.
Okay. So far, I share that, by the way. I'm particularly the Tibetan. I have a lot of resistance just to stuff in Tibetan. Okay. Anything else? Any burning ones? Yes.
I would say another thing that's kind of confusing is the things that you're supposed to be doing. And if you're not doing, then you have to do purifications, and you don't know where in the world you're going with that.
So the thing, when you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing,
you have to do purification.
Then you have to do purification.
You're not really sure all of the ramifications of what's involved with that. It's a bit confusing and overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Yeah.
The changing concept of spirit or God.
Like, where's God in Buddhism kind of thing? Is that what you're saying? Coming from a theistic background, like to Buddhism where it's non-theistic, like how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
Good point. Gosh, that was one of my hang-ups for, it still is in a sense, but I've made peace with it. But that's really good. Good point.
I think that when you're raised in America and you don't have all these different religions that are foreign to us, that this becomes foreign because of the packages that we are sold. And that if you don't go along with the socialized package, therefore you are supposed to feel guilty because you've chosen something different.
Yeah, exactly. We're really the first and second generations of Buddhists in this country. And so we're definitely automatically an outlier, you know? And for some people, they're very uncomfortable being labeled outliers. So, it's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. Wait a minute. We need to use the mic. Sorry.
Kind of add to that, there's a stereotype with Buddhists. If you tell someone that you're becoming a Buddhist, or they automatically think you're going to shave your head and start wearing robes.
Yeah.
So there's a negativity stereotype with Buddhism here in the Western culture, I think.
Yeah. Good point. A cult-like feel. Yeah. Oh, that's enough for now. Robbie, would you like to start the conversation by answering? Robbie's going to jump in and help me out if I get stuck on any of this. Can you see? All right. Joey's got good eyes with his glasses on. Okay, so I don't want to, I may jump around, but the foreignness of it is just what we have to get used to, isn't it? Lama Yeshe, who's the founder of the FPMT, the gentleman just to the left of the Dalai Lama, he and Lama Zopa were my first two teachers, and he used to say, because he has students all over the world, he said, when you go to Italy, make it Italian Buddhism. Forget about Tibetan Buddhism. If you go to you know, for America, it's American Buddhism. And those of you who were in the basement, how many people ever went to the basement before we moved here? Now this, but that basement was like designed to be American Buddhist. This is much more Tibetan Buddhist because we didn't have a teacher at the time. And so we put, the walls were, Linda, I can't think of her last name, but she was an interior designer. She picked out all the colors. She painted the walls like five times until she got the color just right. And there was gold leaf and blah, blah, blah. And just, it was quite beautiful, but it was much less foreign. But still, we got the statues and everything. And I'll say this. Everything that we have here at Kadampa Center that looks strange to you, I could probably, or somebody else, or guess you somebody could explain to you what the symbolic meaning is. But it's all meant to be helpful for our practice. And so if you see it and you go, that's off-putting, which I did that. You know, you're talking about the iconography and stuff. That's off-putting. It's only because we don't know what it means, probably. And so over time, even ritual, even the prayers in Tibetan, I still wish everything was in English because I don't speak Tibetan. And but Geshe-la has the final say-so, so I go along with it. But, you know, it doesn't help my mind to read things in Tibetan. Mantras are in Sanskrit. I understand the point of doing mantras in Sanskrit. But anyway, there is going to be some resistance in the beginning, I think, for just mentally coming from a Judeo-Christian background, and you walk in here and you go, wow, look at all the colors and this. And I think if, you know, we have newcomer sessions and stuff like that, and there are opportunities to ask questions about iconography and find out what it means. For example, you know, this is a symbolic of the enlightened body. Okay, and the stupa is symbolic of enlightened mind, and the texts are symbolic of enlightened speech, and Tara is symbolic of active compassion, and so on. And there are water bowl offerings that we put up, because water, there's plenty of water, and we can give without attachment. So everything that's up there is meant to be used for practice and to help us transform our mind. And I invite you to look at it that way, and if you don't understand it, ask questions. And that's enough. Massive lists, and I can sort of fold that into also how complicated Buddhism is. First of all, our minds are pretty complicated. They say there are 84,000 delusions, so there's 84,000 remedies for those delusions. So talk about a list. That's a real list. But so there are a lot of lists. What do you think the point of the lists are? Just guessing. I mean, you're really supposed to. It's an oral tradition, yeah.
It's also a very natural way to learn.
Yeah.
Publications. Every year we see the best 10 lists of this and that.
Yeah. Yeah, these lists, there's like, there's different, like for suffering, there's the list of 3 and 6. And the 8 sufferings, you know, and then of course there's many more, but they're different lists for us to contemplate. And ideally, in the beginning, you read the list. You might say, okay, there's the suffering of pain, and then there's the suffering of change, and then there's the suffering called pervasive suffering. That's the list of 3. And we might, and we try to memorize those 3. And then in meditation, we try to analyze those in more depth. Then we go to the list of 6, you know, and then if we've memorized them, it's supposed to be an aid to meditation. But sometimes it's bewildering. So we take it as much as we can. It's like, again, I want to make sure that people get it. It's not a lot of shoulds in Buddhism. You don't have to memorize the list. You can write them down. But it is a natural way to learn. And it's very difficult. It's meant, memorizing the list and meditating on the list is meant to transform our mind. Okay? So, for example, meditating on suffering not only helps us get in touch with our own suffering, but have compassion for others. That's the point. So the lists have a bigger point. And then we'll talk about how vast Buddhism is. Well, they, let me think, the, I heard a number one time. I can't remember. But when Atisha and when in the early days when they were bringing Buddhism from India to Tibet, there were thousands and thousands of texts. It was unbelievable how many mountains of text. You know, the Christians have one book, a Bible, and that's kind of cryptic. But in Buddhism, look. This is just the beginning. This is the sumbum and the kumbum. These are the Buddha's words and commentaries and by Lama Tsongkhapa. And there's way more than that. But guess what? It's all been distilled into the Lam Rim. That's the cool thing. The Lam Rim are the stages to the path to enlightenment. It's like, this is what you need to know. To transform your mind, you need to know, the meditations on renunciation, meditations on bodhicitta, on emptiness, the beings with the lower capabilities, the middling and the superior capabilities, and so on. It really has been packaged, even though it looks like a big package, it's been packaged in the Lam Rim. And so that's the beauty of Tibetan Buddhism, is it is so vast, but it's been packaged by Lama Tsongkhapa. Actually, Atisha in the Lamp to the Path, and then Lama Tsongkhapa sort of expanded on that. So it's really amazing that we have this and it's not that hard. We can understand these steps to the path. And people that practice it, that practice it conscientiously, can actually see their mind shift, can see a positive shift. Why? And the reason I know that is I've had some small benefit, but I mean, this thing wouldn't be alive now if it didn't bring some results. You know, Buddhism's been an oral tradition. It's 2,500 years old. It goes from teacher to disciple all the way back to the Buddha. So it's an unbroken lineage. So it's kind of, and then the Lam Rim is the way we can make sense of it, because it is vast. Emptiness is confusing. emptiness. here's the way to make emptiness easy. No, it's not either. I don't know how to make emptiness easy, but here I can tell you this. Here's the way to make it practical. Here's the way to make it practical. In Buddhism, I mean, we can pretty much all see that. For example. When everybody's looking at this glass or this cup of water, and we instinctively think that we're all seeing it the same, wouldn't you say that's true? Everybody's saying, "Oh yeah, that's a cup of water." Everybody's seeing the same cup. You know, if a dog came in, he wouldn't necessarily see a cup of water, would he? He might see something to play with or to break. So everybody, but in fact, everybody has their own interpretation or having a slightly different experience of this object. You're all having a slightly different experience of what I'm saying and your experience of Kadampa Center. But we think that how we see it is the way it is. We're quite arrogant about that. When in fact, what's actually happening is our mind, it's like a projector in our head. Our mind is, objects come into our field of vision, for example, or hearing, taste, touch, whatever sense faculty it is. But let's just talk about vision. Objects come into our field of vision, and we immediately project onto that object our interpretation. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Does it come from, it comes from our culture, it comes from our, blah, blah, blah. But the main, it's our karma. That's what is the creating the projection, the interpretation. So we are all having our unique karmic projection of reality. Do you get that? It's very important that we're not all having the same life. We're having a unique life that's the resultant of our former actions that are forcing us to see the world a certain way. There is no inherently existent out there reality that exists independent of my mind projecting it. There is no reality out there. So here's one. This is the way I see it. I mean, it's a quick way to see it. It's not very profound, but it might be helpful. It's as if we're walking into a movie theater and there's a blank screen, you know, nothing on there, and then the projector in our head forces us to see the movie called My Life. Okay? The world things are empty of any inherent objective out there, independent existence that exists independent of my mind projecting it. Okay? Now that's not that hard to see that. I think we can all have some sense about that. But where's that coming from? Where are the karmic seeds coming from that are the projector? They're coming from our former actions. They're coming from our former actions, virtue and non-virtue. So if you want to be forced to see yourself as suffering, you have no choice. In the moment that dentist hits your third molar nerve, you can't call that pleasure. You know, when the karma is forcing you to have a projection of your life, either painful or pleasant or whatever, it is happening and you can't change it in that moment. But the way you deal with your moments of mind has everything to do with what the future is going to look like. So again, if we want to have a karmic, because there's no objective reality independent of our mind, and because karma creates the seeds that ripen into our experience, you know, if we're smart, we practice virtue because we want to be forced to see ourselves basically in paradise, don't we? And we don't want to see ourselves suffering. There is no inherent objective reality independent of my mind projecting it. So again, virtue is the source of happiness and non-virtue. This is not a moral conversation we're having. This is common sense. And at some level, if you believe in karma, that what goes around comes around. So if I train myself in anger and jealousy and pride, it's not surprising that I see the world as a place that's unworkable and that I don't have a lot of friends. You know, and if I train myself in compassion and kindness, I might become, you know, dogmatic, you know, once in a while. But, you know, probably going to have more friends. I'm going to be somebody that people feel safe around because they know I'm not going to pull a rug out from under them or stab them in the back and so on. So there's, you know, this is one way to think about emptiness. This is where emptiness really hits the road. And ethics depends upon understanding that I'm not the center of the universe. So emptiness, again, selflessness. You know, true compassion is not an act of self-centered selfishness. It's not. So all the delusions, I'm not going to be able to go into this anymore, but all the delusions are completely uprooted by the correct view of the world or emptiness. The wisdom of emptiness is the tap root for anger, jealousy, pride, you name it. All the things that destroy our happiness, the delusions, are all caused by our egocentric, self-centered attitude. And that's completely uprooted by the correct view of self, selflessness, emptiness. So that's all I'm going to say. But that's kind of a quick and dirty down to earth. Okay, go ahead. Right, one more.
How do you see emptiness, though? Is there emptiness meditation? Or?
Yeah, there are definite. There are emptiness meditations that there's different meditations that you do. There's a lot of studying that you do. But here's the deal. You won't see emptiness unless you're in a meditative state until you become enlightened. You can't see emptiness directly while your eyes are open and while your senses are open. You can't experience it. You have to do it in deep meditative equipoise on emptiness, where nothing appears. So this is a little tricky, but there are definite meditations that will help us develop a gradual understanding and experience of emptiness. And then before we can actually have a direct experience of emptiness, we gradually learn to live as if emptiness were the way it was. So we don't take things so seriously, and we don't take ourselves so seriously, and we don't get, you know, so wrapped up in egocentric trips.
Yeah.
That's the take-home message, yeah. So let's do another one. There was one about forgiveness that I thought was really good. Self-forgiveness. Who wants to say something about that? Anybody? Yeah, you have high expectations, you don't live up to your expectations, and you beat yourself up, right?
It's kind of hard to be compassionate to others if you can't be compassionate with yourself. Got to start the practice somewhere, and I'm the only person I'm with all of the time.
Mm-hmm. So how do you have compassion for yourself?
Awareness of emptiness.
That's good, but that's not easy, is it? Yeah. Anybody? Yeah, go ahead.
The way I have compassion for myself is I try to look at myself as another person because I'm hard on myself.
Mm-hmm.
But if I think of myself, if I try to take a step back and say, you know, if I was myself speaking to myself, would I be as hard on me as I am?
Right.
No, I wouldn't. I'd be forgiving. I'd be understanding. I would, you know, try to be compassionate. So it's almost like taking a step back
mm-hmm.
and looking at myself from outside
mm-hmm.
as another person.
I read somewhere where sometimes it's easier to forgive others if you view them as a child. And mm-hmm. in that sense of, and if you put that on yourself, viewing yourself for your inner child, because it's easier to forgive a child for doing something than it is, you know, to forgive another adult because you have that judgment and that, you know, pre-notions of what they are, but to look at a child and forgive them mm-hmm. for doing something is much easier. So if you sort of, I guess, tap into your inner child, and it would be easier to forgive yourself and if you look at yourself that way, too.
Mm-hmm. So what is the result of forgiveness? I mean, what are we looking for when we say forgiveness? What is that? Once you've forgiven yourself, what has actually happened to you in your mind? What's actually happened?
You're not focusing on the difference.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say we've let go, haven't we? But we've let go in a very profound way. That's some sort of healing. Would you say the word healing would be just, you know, here? You know, it's like some sort of, I guess to use the Christian term, redemption. Yeah, some sort of healing has taken place when we can let go. But how do we get there? How do we get there? That's the big question. Now, some people bring up the question, well, how does understanding emptiness make, how do you understanding emptiness cause us to be more compassionate? And that's a good question because, you know, you think, well, I mean, nothing exists inherently and everything is a projection of the mind. And so how does that make me more compassionate? Well, the teachings say that a Buddha, for example, sees sentient beings as so deluded. We are so caught up in appearances and believing in appearances. It's not that we see things a certain way, but we believe in the appearances that we have. And then we get drug into all kinds of drama, attachment, aversion, anger, jealousy, all that stuff. And so a Buddha's heart just literally weeps because he sees how sentient beings are so deluded because we see things in a perverted, we hallucinate our reality, believe in it, and cause tremendous problems for ourselves and others. And so a Buddha has amazing compassion for sentient beings because he sees how we cause our own suffering. He understands, she understands that. So it's, that's part of it. And I think here's another thing about self-forgiveness. It is a process of letting go. And you might say, well, because probably somebody in here has committed adultery. I committed adultery. Okay. And you're beating yourself up about having done the wrong thing, you know, and you've shamed yourself and your family and the other person, and blah, blah, blah. Bad news. And you're a bad person for doing that. You know, and your conversation really is quite a put down. And you feel guilty, right? So in Buddhism, guilt, there's no room for guilt. Guilt is not an appropriate response to poisoning yourself. Regret, yes, but guilt is not. So guilt keeps that negativity and the shame of it all in place, doesn't it? You know, if you drink poison, you don't feel guilty. You go, you want to get rid of it. So regret is a proper reaction to something we've done. But self-forgiveness, how do I let go? How do I let go? And I think this really boils down to either if you're really good, you can just let go. And that is the essence of forgiveness, is letting go. But if you're in compassion for yourself, and for other people is the key. Okay? Having compassion for yourself. I'm a conditioned being. I'm deluded. I'm still caught in samsara. I'm sorry. I'm not perfect yet. I'm really working on myself. But and in as much as you can, you let go little by little. But here, I think Buddhist purification practice is what I think this is about. And I've done some of this myself, and I can speak from a little bit of experience. But you bring to mind, it's in Buddhism, it's not about hiding from your past. It's real important to confess it and be honest and be straightforward about what you've done and how you've harmed yourself and other beings. Be very upfront about that. And then purify it. You purify it. The first point is acknowledging what you've done. And then you confess it, you know, and then you can do some sort of practices. Maybe you do the rosary, or maybe you do mantras, or you do 100,000 Vajrasattva mantras or prostrations, or you go apologize to the person that you've done wrong, you know, or all the people that you've done wrong. Like in AA, people in AA make a big list of all the people that they've messed around with or screwed up or done wrong, and they try to clean it up. They try to make amends for those. I think that's really important. So, you know, do you know about the four opponent powers and purification practice? I think the result of purification practice is forgiveness. It's like, okay, it may not be total and complete, but it's like self-forgiveness comes slowly. You know, now for Christians, it's much easier because you're instantly forgiven. But that didn't work for, that doesn't work for everybody. That's why a lot of you are here. I'm serious. That's why I'm here. Because it didn't work for me. But, you know, in Buddhism, it's a gradual process of letting go, and having compassion for yourself. Really important. Have compassion. She's about to jump out of, go ahead.
When you're speaking about letting go, is it something tangible you're letting go of? Is it you're letting go of attachment? Is it you're letting go of an anticipated outcome? What are you letting go of?
What do you think?
When people refer to in Buddhism just let go.
Yeah.
Is it
when you're doing meditation on your breath, and you're off on some fantasy trip, okay? You're watching your breath, and you're off on a fantasy trip, and your commitment to yourself is to be mindful or recollect the breath, right? But now through your little introspective alertness, you notice, oh, I'm off on a fantasy trip, and you let it go and come back. That's it. It's just letting go. Nothing more profound than that. Now, it's not easy to let go of something you're obsessing about. I told this story early on. I have to tell it again. Annabelle, some of you know Annabelle, my six-year-old. When she was 4 years old, she was in school with this little boy in her pre-K class named Ben. And she and Ben, they had a little cot. They had to take naps at school. So they would, their cots were next to each other. And sometimes they would hold hands. And Ben would chase her all over the playground and stuff like this. And so I teased her a little bit about when she was four about being, I said, is it Ben your boyfriend? And no, and you know, she'd go like that. Well, now Ben's in her class in first grade. She just started this week. And I said, now, Annabelle, Ben's in your class in the first grade. And she said, it's a six-year-old saying, she said, I'm not obsessed with him anymore. She knows what it is to be obsessed. So obsession is attachment, isn't it? Attachment and letting go of obsession. So now she's not worried about Ben. Ben's not her problem. She's going to try to find a new boyfriend, of course, but Ben's not the one. We talked, one of the things I talked about earlier, and I think this is a good time to talk about it. This is, because this is a problem, I think, we all have with Buddhism in the beginning. It looks like that we can't have fun, doesn't it? It looks like attachment is our enemy and we can't have fun. And so, let's see, I'm going to write it down here. Addiction, this is not my term, to deliciousness. Now, I heard this from a Thai Buddhist saint. His name is Achin Buddhadasa, and he was like 80 years old, was in his 70s when I heard him speak. And he said, we're all addicted to deliciousness. What does that mean? What does that mean? It means we want everything that's good, and we want nothing that's bad. So, eight worldly dharmas. Remember that teaching? The four good ones are pleasure, gain, fame, and praise. Everything that's positive in the world can be subsumed in those four categories. So we want that. And the more that we obsess with having pleasure, gain, fame, and praise, the more uncomfortable we are, aren't we? And guess what? When we don't have it, how do we feel? Not so good. When we do get it, we're clinging so tightly to that pleasure, whatever it is, that we can't fully enjoy it. And then we're over here and we lose it. It's got, the marriage breaks up and the wife runs off, or the husband runs off with the new girlfriend. Oh my God, that is so painful. Because what we wanted, now it's been ripped away from us. So, Is the problem getting what you want? Like, is the problem the pleasure, the intimacy, sexual intimacy, or having a nice car, house, or having a good reputation and people say nice? Is that the problem? People think that Buddhism is saying we can't have those things. Is that the problem? What's the problem? The craving, the obsession. The more we obsess about delicious things, the more we're going to suffer. When we don't have it, we're going to suffer. When we do have it, we're not going to fully enjoy it. And when we lose it, we're really going to have problems. You know, fear is all based on this mentality. Fear is based on attachment. The more you crave life, the more you fear death. Right? It's the same thing. The more you crave to have anything, the more you fear losing it. So, this is really important because, and the opposite side, loss, pain, disgrace, and blame. Is that bad to lose something? Is that really bad? Is that worth, somebody bad-mouthing you? Is that necessarily the cause of suffering? Does it have to be? Not really. Not really. It's only to the degree that we crave to hear nice things said about us, that when somebody badmouths us, that we suffer. When our reputation gets smashed, you know, and we show up on the front page of the NNO. Ooh, I don't want to be there. Yeah. I mean, you know, and your reputation is destroyed. My gosh, it hurts so bad because we would crave. This is the one we crave the most, is a good reputation. So attachment is not bad. You hear that? It is not bad. Please don't hear that obsession and attachment are bad. The Buddha never said that, did he? What did he say? It just hurts. It just hurts. It makes you miserable. Now, if you don't want to be miserable, and I don't want to be miserable, we have to learn how to let go. And how do we let go? How do we learn how to let go? We practice the Lam Rim. You know, we learn it gradually. My mom never even mentioned this to me. And my dad, when I told him I was a Buddhist, he said, "Son, don't you think if Buddhism had anything to offer, I would have known about it a long time ago?" Oh my gosh. Well, are we out of time? Yes, we are. Okay, good. Good time to wrap it up. So if you have questions about other things, please, I'll stick around for about 2 minutes. I'm joking. Let's do the dedication prayers, please. So the dedication prayers from Master Shanti Deva. Now, Jill, do we do all these from top to bottom? Okay, we'll do Shanti Deva's first, okay? It's everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, attain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power. And may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chinrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland's teachings, transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. To the one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of non-objectifying compassion, Manjushri, master of stainless wisdom, Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the sages of the land of snow, Dalama Tsongkhapa, at your feet I make request. Now we'll do Lama Geshe-gelik seven times. Tari tu, tari tu, re, so, ha. Om 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 dari du dari du re so ha ha. Om dari du re so ha. Om dari du re so ha. Okay. Thank you for your attention and your questions. That was fun.